This audio stream is a rough edit of the proceedings at the conference From JFK Through 9-1-1, 42 Years of State-Sponsored Terrorism. The conference was held at the Central Library in downtown Portland, Oregon, on the afternoon of Sunday, November the 20th, 2005, from about 1 to 4:30 p.m. This audio stream is the second of two for this conference. Much of the content of this audio recording is expert testimony recorded at other conferences held over the last several years that trace covert operations from the mysterious circumstances surrounding the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, America's 35th president, on November 22nd, 1963, to the increasingly discredited official account of the events of September 11, 2001, as embodied in the Keene-Zelikoff Commission report released July 22, 2004. The facilitator for this event, whose voice you will hear at intervals throughout the proceedings, is Richard Frager of the PDX 9/11 Truth Alliance. And I'm Glenn Owen, KWFM on the World Wide Web.
Now here I would submit is a very important diagram that I commend to your attention, and I want to tarry and look at it for a moment. We are dealing with state-sponsored false flag terrorism. I don't mean state-sponsored in the sense that it has to be sponsored by the entire command structure of the country in question, but that it is carried forward by a private network ensconced and infesting decisive nodal points in the state apparatus of that country. I'll try to show you what I mean. Here we have to distinguish a world of patsies, the people that you hear about. I'll try to show you some of this in detail. The people we can call the dupes, the useful idiots, the fanatics, the police agents, the double agents, the provocateurs, in short, the Oswalds. The Fall Guys. Lee Harvey Oswald, "I'm just a patsy," direct quote. That's one group. The Moles. This is the group of government officials, the network of government officials whose loyalty is not to the command structure, the Constitution, or their country in some diffuse sense, but rather their loyalty goes to a private intelligence network, a private clique, faction, a group of putschists, if you will, people trying to have a coup d'etat. You also have to distinguish the professional killers. These are the cold-blooded technicians of murder. This is the sort of area where you see retired veterans of the Special Forces, the Delta Force, the CIA Operations Directorate, and so on down the line. The old boys. At the end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, the term for this group in Washington was the asteroids. All of them operate in a brainwashed world of the controlled corporate media, which establishes the terms of the debate. Now, the patsies are up front. The moles are known, but the fact that they're moles is not well known. The professional killers don't ever want to become known. They'd rather be completely anonymous. Let's just look at the patsies for a second. You can think of Oswald. You can think of this group of 19. Think of Mohammed Atta, too. We'll get to him in just a minute. These are false flag terrorists. I would submit that most of the time, they are pieces of human wreckage. They are psychotics. They are people with criminal intent, criminal energy, but not much else. They have low mental ability. It helps because they're not supposed to realize what's going to happen to them, because at some point it's going to go badly for them. They're psychopaths, sociopaths, and they're ideologues. They're obsessive about various ideological points. They're also capable of being very abrasive, very obvious, and very anxious to be noticed, like Atta and these people, right? Going to strip clubs, or getting into fights with people about parking spaces, and all sorts of incomprehensible behavior that seems only finalized towards making sure people remember that they were there. Now, most of these people can't get through life without a comprehensive support network. They can't make it. That's why we find so many of them in South Florida. Why South Florida? Well, there's something called CIA Miami Station, the so-called JM Wave, The CIA is not supposed to have big offices in the continental United States, but they do. And the biggest one is in Florida, with the target, of course, being Cuba. It goes back to the early 1960s, and that's precisely where we find all of these terrorists hanging out in these motels, bars, and strip clubs. So they require comprehensive support networks. They require protection from against ordinary law enforcement, because these are the kinds of people who are likely to get arrested for being drunk and disorderly, for petty theft, traffic violations, and so on down the line. There's got to be somebody from the CIA Office of Security or something else there to make sure that they don't get put in the hooscow. The most important thing about the patsies that I would suggest to you is that when it comes down to it, in the crucial instance, they are physically and mentally incapable of carrying out the large-scale actions ascribed to them. A supermarket-caliber terrorist who can blow up a bus or a shop is not capable of these tremendous feats that are associated with 9/11. So we've done the patsies. Let's turn our attention, I guess, next to the moles. Now, the moles are government officials, but they don't work for the government. They work for this private network. What's their task? Well, they have two, I think, essentially. They have to preserve the patsies from arrest or elimination, because you've got to have the patsies. They're indispensable. You can't pin it on them if they're in jail. They also have to supervise the cover-up. This is absolutely decisive, because whatever you can do can be investigated and blown, but not if you have moles supervising the cover-up. Now, you remember Colleen Rowley in her little complaint from Minneapolis saying, I thought that the leaders of the FBI in Washington were a bunch of moles. Well, bravo, Mrs. Rowley. Indeed, David Frasca of the FBI, the head of the Islamic Fundamentalism Department, who rejected the Phoenix memo, rejected the Minneapolis demands, and so forth, is a prime candidate as mole of 9/11. This unfortunate General Myers, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the United States, the guy who was unable to scramble a single jet fighter until the Pentagon had been hit by something. And now a couple of weeks ago, he goes on the television to talk about his war crimes in Iraq, and he said, well, I didn't read the Taguba report. I don't read things like that. They don't get to my desk. He seems to make a business about not knowing anything. This is another case where you wonder, could General Myers find his way to the men's room without the help of a CIA covert operation? How about the Federal Aeronautics Administration employee who a couple of weeks ago was found to have been burning the tapes, taped interviews done with air traffic controllers the day of, 11th to 12th of September, and all that evidence has now been destroyed? Well, that looks like another mole to me. The only thing I have to warn you of here, my caveat, is that you cannot project backwards to the moles. Because the problem is this. If the terrorism operation is successful, it tends to shunt the entire government like an express train going through a switch. It puts the entire state machine on a new track. At that point, bureaucratic conservatism, self-preservation, all the bureaucratic instincts kick in. In retrospect, it looks like all the members of the government are moles. But that does not mean that they were witting before the fact, or even that they're witting after the fact. So you have to be careful about the people to whom you ascribe witting knowledge of what is actually going on, because these are usually fewer than it appears. Now we have to think about the professional killers. Let's look at them for a second. Now, these are not bunglers. These are not psychotics. Well, not in the crude sense. They may be morally insane. Professional experts with state-of-the-art training and equipment. These are cold-blooded technocrats of death. They are eminently capable of performing terror attacks. They're detached. They're not ideological. They're often mercenaries. They're often in it for money. They want secrecy. They don't want attention. They don't want publicity. They want to keep a low profile, no profile. Their occupational hazard, of course, is that they tend to be liquidated after the fact. But their goal is never to be heard from again, although they'd rather not have it be that way. The other component the brainwashed world. But the indispensable thing, of course, that I don't show on the picture is a command cell. It's almost certain not to be in government, but somewhere privatized. You have to go back to Ronald Reagan's first term and his executive order 12333, which essentially privatized most of the Cold War functions of the CIA, put them into these companies you find around Washington, the so-called Beltway Bandits, if you will. Those are the retired Special Forces, Delta Force, SEALs, Special Air Services of Great Britain are very big and very aggressive. U.S. Air Force Intelligence with their utopian ideas, Defense Intelligence Agency, and so on down the line, can staff it. And to whose drum they march is then an interesting and important question. Finally, the corporate media. They are the indispensable ingredient, because without them you can't have anything. You have to have mass propaganda to accredit and spread and pound the official version of the events into the minds of people, and to smooth over the inevitable absurdities, contradictions, impossibilities, and so forth, of the official story. Bourrage de crâne, good word. Mass brainwashing in the Anglo-American tradition is what they propose. Now, if you want to show this to people at a perhaps comprehensible level, there's an interesting movie called The Package, made in the late 1980s, that does show the levels of moles, dupes, and professional killers. It's got Gene Hackman as a good U.S. Army sergeant who stumbles upon a plot by a clique of U.S. and Soviet officers, there's the private network, who are determined to assassinate Gorbachev in order to stop disarmament and detente, which they don't like. We have Tommy Lee Jones as the professional killer, the hitman. The U.S. generals and Soviet generals who work together are the moles. And we have a dim-witted army person from the stockade that they spring from the army brig jail and use him as a patsy. So I recommend this interesting movie, The Package, with Gene Hackman and Tommy Lee Jones. It's the only thing from Hollywood I've ever seen that has any connection to reality in this. Now, the Kane-Hamilton Commission, the nicest thing we can say is that they begged the question. They have assumed as given that which they had to prove, their official story. They haven't proven the official story. They haven't come anywhere near it. It's a scandal. It's an abject failure. And as I'll try to show, the tragedy of the Kane-Hamilton Commission is that it leaves the door wide open to future terrorism, because the real terrorist networks have remained totally untouched, totally uninvestigated, totally unknown, and the 19 patsies have been the center of the story. And on the 26th of July, an interesting date, the report is going to be issued, but it's going to be not released to you, but released to the White House so it can be censored. So we'll have a censorship of a censorship, and what comes out at the end is probably going to be something like dishwater or hogwash. I guess we'll have to read it when it comes. Here we have it. Joyce Lynn, as I think you've heard already, has done a wonderful job in lining up the various contradictions and impossibilities in this group. Their conflicts of interest. She represents the CIA. Lee Hamilton represents the Washington establishment. Lehman just did a hatchet job on the New York City firemen and policemen, and so on down the line. A wretched performance. However, despite the idiotic direction of the entire thing, it nevertheless, as an unavoidable and unintended byproduct, produced a number of interesting revelations. Part of it is that thanks to this fellow here, Clark, it is clear that Bush, Condoleezza, and others lied. Well, yes, your government failed you and I failed you. I wanted to propose this man Clark for the Academy Award this year, the Oscar, for his performance in this hearing, because this was one of the most exceptional pieces of histrionics that I've ever seen. He was able to sell himself to the victims' families as somehow a friend of theirs. You just have to remember that everything he says goes in the direction of attempting to accredit and shore up the bankrupt official version. In other words, he's the guy who says to Bush, don't worry about Iraq, worry about Al-Qaeda, when he should have been saying, let's look at the moles inside our own government, which he did not do. rushing ahead, let's just remember that despite the activities of this pseudo-commission, cover-up commission as it's been termed, there's absolutely no proof of any of the main allegations. There's absolutely no documentary serious proof of Al-Qaeda, Bin Laden, the 19, Atta, Sheehy, and so forth. A white book was promised by General Powell, never delivered. There's no proven connection to Afghanistan, no proof of who the hijackers were, if there were any hijackers, no proof of foreign origin, and nobody has ever been convicted for anything in a fair trial. One of the first skeptics was former German Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, who said it's wrong to invoke the NATO Article 5 calling for collective self-defense because it has never been proven that the attack came from outside of the United States. So the entire NATO Council was stampeded under the results of these events.
Lester Tarpley. He's coming up too here in a second.
Now here in the earshot of a man that I call the tenant of the White House, because that's all he is, I would like to stress my thesis that 9/11 is an example of state-sponsored, false flag, synthetic terrorism organized from inside the U.S. command structure, but not by Cheney, at a level much higher than Cheney, by the forces above and behind the Oval Office. Now, there are people here from the peace movement, and I would like to give you my thesis that if you want to stop the war in Iraq, the only way to do it is to explode the 9/11 issue. If you watched Bush's speech on the 28th of June, at the last point that his war policy was about to collapse, you will have noticed that he talked very little about Iraq and all about 9/11. The Doonesbury comic strip parodied him saying, 9/11, hard, 9/11, lessons of 9/11, hard. The whole basis of the regime, the Republican Party, the foreign policy, and everything is 9/11. If you don't break the 9/11 issue, he will keep his 30-40% base of cretins and continue to prosecute the war as long as he can stay in office, and that may be a very long time. The rogue network that is responsible for these things, and I'm talking about that secret team that brought you the Kennedy assassination, the Gulf of Tonkin, it didn't start with these two. It's been going for 100 years. It infests all of these buildings, the federal court, the old executive office building, Oliver North's playground. It's been around for a long time. They are in a desperate flight forward. Their land army is collapsing. Their financial structures are collapsing. Their political standing is collapsing. And the only thing that neocons know how to do is war. War and martial law. The bombs in London, state-sponsored terrorism on July 7th. Scotland Yard knew in advance and informed foreign bigwigs. Atlantic Blue, top off three, triple play, are the overall covering exercises. The specific cover to run it through the bureaucracy was Peter Power and Pfizer Associates. What does this tell us? The invisible government, the rogue network, is giving orders to the two over here in this building. What's the program of the invisible government? Martial law in Great Britain. The other thing they want is an attack on Iran. So that is why the task for this movement to end the war in Iraq is the same issue as blowing up the 9/11 question in the face of these two who have decided to become the willing tools, spokesmen, and wholly owned proprietors of the rogue network. We're going to set up a monitoring procedure so that we can monitor those kinds of maneuvers and drills that are used for the cover of future terror operations. We want to stop future terror at the same time that we cast light on the old terror that's still with us. This is the 9/11 regime ruling right here.
We don't need no Carl Rover.
9/11 was not only an event that changed history in the way we live, it was also an environmental disaster of historic proportions. The World Trade Center was a city with its own zip code. When it fell, Hundreds of tons of asbestos were pulverized and could be inhaled, and they were taken by the plume miles beyond ground zero. In the World Trade Center were over 50,000 computers. They each made with over 4 pounds of lead. You had tens of thousands of fluorescent light bulbs, each of which had enough mercury to contaminate a quarter of a city block. Smoke detectors with radioactive americium-241. A month after the disaster, they found very ultrafine particles that were the highest of any found around the world, including at the burning Kuwaiti oil fields. The air had the alkalinity of drain cleaner, and yet the EPA said early on, good news, the air is safe to breathe. Now, we know several things. We know that not only were they mistaken, we know they were lying. A memo showed that. We also know that the White House Council on Environmental Quality changed at least one of their press releases. Now, why was the White House so keen to get people back into Lower Manhattan? Well, the Inspector General's report issued in August of 2003 said one of the reasons was that there was a keenness to reopen Wall Street. 3.5 years later, we're beginning to see the results of these disastrous policies of the White House. Over half of the heroes who toiled at Ground Zero now have debilitating respiratory symptoms, and we see analogous symptoms among residents. And by the way, $125 million, which was offered to the Ground Zero workers, was later rescinded by the White House.
Half of New York City does not buy the official story as it is. And I can tell you, you go to New York and you talk to people and you ask them, do you think they knew or do you think maybe they blew up the towers? And about half the people will say, yeah. So why don't we go and show some strength in the street?
What I see on September the 11th is a warmed over version of the Kennedy assassination. Inside an hour, one lone culprit is named, Osama bin Laden. Boy, we hadn't heard much about him lately, have we? And yet that was the whole, you know, cause celebre of this thing. They told us that flames brought down the towers and that the plane crashed into the Pentagon. And yet they went around, gathered up all the camera evidence. They went around and scraped up all the steel. They destroyed evidence. They hid away evidence. They fabricated evidence. We see the same methodology going on. Now, this leads to the ultimate question. My God, would Americans allow deadly attacks on other Americans? You damn betcha. They did it on December the 7th, 1941. It's now beyond question that Roosevelt, Marshall, and others knew Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. They allowed it to happen to further their political goal, which was a united America into World War II. We know from the Northwoods documents that they were going to do that in 1962, and we know from the Gulf of Tonkin that they'll use a phony excuse, a provocation, to further their political agendas. All I'm saying is we must start working together to expose the truth of what's going on, and we need to quit squabbling with each other over details.
However, mainstream media no longer produces news for the mainstream population, nor should we consider it plural. Instead, it's more accurate to speak of big media today as the corporate media, and to use the term in a singular sense, as it refers to a monolithic top-down power structure of self-interested news giants.
30 years ago, Ben Bagdikian wrote his first book on media monopoly. He said there's 50 major media corporations in the United States, and we were all somewhat shocked. His latest book has us down to 6, so that in one generation we've consolidated media from 50 to 6 corporations. Now, many of us know about the lawsuit that Steve Wilson and Jane Acri filed against Fox about 5 years back for failure to cover bovine growth hormone, Monsanto's BGH in milk. They won that lawsuit in Florida as a whistleblowers, but then they ended up losing in appellate court, based on the fact that Fox's defense was it's not against the law to lie to the public. Therefore, you can't be a whistleblower unless you violated the law. And they won on that. And so what Fox was saying, and what many of the corporations that put grease in support of Fox, was that they own the news. They will tell journalists what the news will be. So if you've seen the Outbox movie, you know that journalists are saying, we get daily report, daily commands from top down. This is how you will cover this news story. So we can't trust the Washington Post to be fair and objective about Lockheed Martin defense overruns. And we can't trust ABC to report about Halliburton's and sole source contracts in Iraq. And we can't trust any of them to tell us the truth about 9/11 and many of the other issues to you, the military that have been on this stage today. Corporate media in this country, we have to say, is no longer feeding the mainstream people. Instead, they're feeding their own self-interest, and most Americans know that. So, people need to look at alternative sources, independent news, and increasingly that's happened. And we know that message, and we know that that's mostly who's here today. And we know that millions of people will see this video, they're going to know what we have done today, they will know about the hearings, and they'll really start to think through what 9/11 is about and the big lies. Thank you.
That breaking through into the media is very important and, of course, very difficult nowadays when the media are so controlled by so few people who have such vested interests in the whole system that makes money out of war, that makes money out of killing people, which we have to stop. And if you want to stop that kind of anti-Americanism, if you want to stop terrorism, there are many, many voices in the Muslim world that say the answer to terrorism isn't war, the answer to terrorism is justice. If America learns the truth about what happened on 9/11, they will want different leadership.
The media needs to receive a message from all of us, okay? Which is this, that as long as the truth remains suppressed about Downing Street memo, the lies of Iraq, the lies of 9/11, the lies of Oklahoma City, and the whole agenda, the imperial agenda that exists behind these catastrophic events and this foreign policy that we have, which is so destructive, militaristic, and lethal on this planet. As long as the media remains silent, I say that they are complicit in the future deaths that will occur tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, and years to come. They will be part of that destructive policy, that part of that lethal and devastating mentality that exists in this country.
Strong, they are real.
And yet, for the first time, we are on the verge of a truly global empire, an empire with no borders. Our own country is involved in what Richard Falk and others call the Global Domination Project. I'm a Christian theologian, so what I am particularly upset about is their claiming to do this empire and this destruction of the world in the name of God, so that when voting time comes, we have a chance to make a difference. But of course, one of the issues is we've got to make sure that our votes are really counted rather than camouflaged by voting machines. There is one thing they will not tolerate. If the truth about 9/11 is revealed, that will bring this administration down, and more than that, it will reveal the values on which this American global domination project is built.
So a little about Code Pink. I think I was invited to speak today because we represent, I guess, the means for getting, one of the means anyway, for getting the truth out. And it's true that we are part of a much larger picture in America of people who are seeking the truth, people who are articulating the truth, and people who are pushing our elected officials and anyone else they can find to hear the truth and to be accountable for the truth. And we started right here in front of the White House in November of 2002, before the war started. The After Downing Street Coalition, which Code Pink is a member of, is doing Our major purpose is to keep Downing Street Minutes alive in the media by putting pressure locally, nationally, letters to the editor, op-eds, etc.
Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, he's still the Transportation Secretary, he said, he was asked by the 9/11 Commission, quote, did the higher level of terrorist chatter before 9/11 result in any action across the government, unquote. He was asked this. His response, no. The FBI, which was well aware there was a high threat level, they told state and local law enforcement in the summer of 2001 that the terrorism threat level was, quote, low, unquote. People, unfortunately, are extremely misinformed. Polls showing up to 70% of the people think that Saddam Hussein was the 9/11 mastermind. 9/11 is just as relevant as ever. Activists working on any issue need to help challenge the official story of 9/11 and cut down the core myth upon which the Bush administration justifies its policies.
You people who are...
Lights.
That conference was from, I think, June of this year, June, July, in D.C. And they had most of the major researchers, as we saw, Paul Thompson, David Ray Griffin, Jim Mars, and many others. It's nice to see the transformation of David Ray Griffin when he wrote his first book, New Pearl Harbor, that he was going with the evidence and not too many historical revelations. And as time goes on, he kind of sees how it's all connected. America's foreign policy, he mentioned vote fraud, which is another issue our group works on. The myth, and we saw some about the myth of the media complicity. And I think Griffin has done really an outstanding job in his two books, the first one on 9/11, the second one on the Kane Commission, Kane-Hamilton Commission. And hopefully he'll even put out another book. He's really a good writer and a good speaker, too, which is an excellent combination. Do we have any questions at all or comments? Okay, I could keep rambling on.
You did explain what that was from, didn't you?
Hmm?
The Washington...
That was from the Washington conference from, I think, June of this year. D.C. Emergence, I forget the whole title, conference. So we do have a sign-up sheet if anybody wants to get on our email list of our 9/11 Truth Alliance. PDX 9/11 Truth Alliance, and we do plan to meet next year and continue going and following through on these issues and whatever else is coming up.
What about Michael Rupert? I mean, he was one of the earlier...
Right. Rupert spoke here last year, and we have a lot of... Mm-hmm. He wrote a good book, and this... The co-founder of From the Wilderness, Jamie Hedge, is also quite an excellent speaker too. And I plan to show a video by him pretty soon. He's not as emotional as Rupert can be. You know, Rupert to me can kind of be doom and gloom, and I don't agree with a lot of his with some of his analysis. I should say, as far as energy goes, There are energy systems that have been repressed. I mean, part of this kind of material too is we're not just assassinations and military coup d'etats and shooting of progressive forces, which is part of our domestic and foreign policy. It's also the cover up of energy of scientific and medical breakthroughs. I mean, I don't want to say that's the reason why anyone gets off, but, you know, the Pentagon has gotten at least $15 trillion since the World War II. Now, that's serious money. That is big money. We're not just talking about Northrop or Lockheed or Boeing or Raytheon or General Dynamics. We're talking about other aerospace companies, pharmaceutical companies. They're all kind of interrelated on that finance capital. That, and you look at DARPA, where the internet came from, and lasers and everything else. I mean, they had this technology decades and decades before it's released to the general public. I remember watching a 60-minute show when it first came on in the 60s, and they were showing they had lasers. They didn't know what to do with them. So they said, look what we got. I think if you remember the show, it's about over 35 years old. They had a light bulb and an incandescent where the filament went on. They said, well, look, we can put the filament back. And I'm going, okay, we're going to spend $5,000 to fix a 10-cent light bulb. But, you know, now lasers are every place, from CD players to scanners at groceries. So I'm just saying, we're also talking about energy systems that I don't think Rupert himself, I mean, he's not a geologist and he's not a physicist. And, you know, he was at Cobb. He was raised in a family.
A drug agent.
Right. Raised in a family.
The garbage out there.
Well, I think I can't disagree with a lot of the things he said, and he did help expose the war games, which is really an important piece of the puzzle. I mean, just like the JFK, I mean, you can't get guys in caves in Afghanistan to have the Air Force have war games out of the country, Eastern Canada, where else? That has to be at the highest levels. And those are direct parallels with 9/11, Oklahoma City, or anything, JFK, anything else you want to look at. It's just people need to really think straight about this stuff. If two-thirds of your money is going to the federal tax money is going to the Pentagon, where has this huge investment gone? It hasn't gone into our schools, public schools, hasn't gone to health care, hasn't gone to having public and open media. You know, where has it gone? And big chunk of that $15 trillion, I think. I mean, you know, right before 9/11, too, there was an article that came out that the Pentagon could not account for $3.3 trillion. That happened just a week before, within days before 9/11. Now, I don't know about you, but $3.3 trillion, that's a lot of public money. That's just great.
Yeah, I wonder where the money's going. What is now the average CEO of a major corporation makes something? I think it's 431 times. More than the average.
Sure. And
it's gone up from what, 50?
Well, back in the 50s, it was anywhere between 15 to 1 to 30 to 1, you know, which is still a big spread. But, you know, with all that money wasted, we easily could have a jobs program for everybody, a housing program for everybody. I mean, Venezuela now has no homeless population. Of course, they're selling a lot of their oil to us. But at least they're investing into social programs, not more weapons of repression. I think, you know, it's really tough to predict the future, but America has about 1,000 bases, foreign and domestic. That's an empire. That's big. And it's really tough to know how long we can keep supporting all these huge military outlays. I'm not sure. Question?
Bruce? Richard, on the JFK assassination, I'm trying to figure out how Kennedy himself did not get some feeling of what was in it. The Kennedy family is very wealthy and has all kinds of supporters everywhere and people everywhere. And had to have commanded some loyalty over the years, just being in president. And if there were some attempts before in his life, RFK being not exactly anybody's one to trust it or not, RFK had to be aware of enemies. You see the direction I'm going. I'm just wondering why he wouldn't have ducked down in the car before then.
Well, the whole thing was the Secret Service was compromised. I mean, you know. Fletcher Prouty said before, you have thousands of people on this whole route looking at buildings, on rooftops, in windows, on the ground. And all that was compromised. Units were told not to come, and the parade route itself was changed to go on that Houston and Elm, where it had a turn and literally slow down to give the snipers a pretty clean shot. And, you know, there were a whole bunch of gunmen, almost like, you know, Martin Luther King. And we're going to do that. In that assassination, they had the snipers, but they also had, in William Pepper's book, we know now there was a military backup team to make sure that King was going to be assassinated that day in 68. And I think, too, in 9/11, is on those planes, there were probably, how did the planes hit the buildings? I don't know, remote control. There are probably multiple ways that those planes were going to go into those buildings. I mean, this huge operation, they're going to make sure that it's successful. So as far as how paranoid Kennedy was, I really don't know. But, you know, you rely on your team to protect you. And, you know, yes?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I used to live in New York City, and I knew a guy who worked in photography. He got robbed a few times, and he told me at one point, he just said, look, the people who do this do not have a full-time job. Figuring out how to get to you is their full-time job. You worked, this president worked. He had meetings to go, he had papers to go. You know, he had a full-time job. His full-time job was not figuring out how to stay alive. But there were people, scores of people, who had a full-time job to figure out how to kill him. It's just like nature, man. It is easier to destroy something than it is to put something together. None of us can defend against a concerted effort to destroy.
I know that something came out recently that RFK talked about or confided in someone that when he heard his brother had been shot, I know there was some official that was there.
Helms of the CIA was actually with Bobby Kennedy at the time of his assassination, most likely just to monitor his response. I mean, the whole thing is pretty well planned out.
Helm,
at that level they knew.
No, later.
Oh, right. Something did come out. That's right. I forgot what that was. I have to review that. Well, yeah, Chappaquiddick, I'm positive, was a covert op. If you really study it, I mean, there's no question about it. That's how they do that. Yeah, it was. No question. But, you really have to go into the material and look at this stuff, and you start seeing patterns that repeat over and over and over again. Bobby Kennedy had said that he was going to reopen his brother's case if he was elected. And I remember back in 68, it sure looked like he definitely had the momentum going to win that election. But it says here, it's also likely he might have carried out his brother's plans to abolish the unconstitutional Federal Reserve System, and that he would have likely carried out JFK's plans to abolish the diabolical CIA to convert covert ops and eventually dismantle it. So I think when you study what Bobby was going to do, I'm pretty sure that he would have continued on his brother's policies that they were interrupted.
What's your source?
No, I'd have to dig it out, Ray. It's just a ton of stuff. So, I guess we should continue with the movie, a key segment of the movie JFK by Oliver Stone, which the character by Donald Sutherland, whose name is X, it was based on Colonel Fletcher Friday, who we saw initially.
So let me set this up.
This movie JFK was the first movie ever reviewed by Time Magazine before it came out, which is pretty amazing how you can do that.
Yeah, if anybody in this room hasn't seen it, or it's been years since you've seen it, you want to see it again. I found it astounding.
How accurate it is.
Yeah. If you saw it when the hubbub, when it first came out, and your ears were
full of cracks in the media,
and
not
too
long.
I just hope it was worth my while, Mr.
I could give you a false name, but I won't. Just call me X.
I've already been warned by the agency, Mr. Whoever, so this is another type of threat.
Not with the agency, Mr. Harrison. And I assume if you've come this far, what I have to say interests you. But I'm not going to name names and tell you who or what I represent. Except to say you're close. Closer than you think. Classified top secret. I was a soldier, Mr. Garrison, in two wars. I was one of those secret guys in the Pentagon who supplies the military hardware, planes, bullets, rifles, for what we call black operations. Black ops, assassinations, coup d'etat, rigging elections, propaganda, psych warfare, and so on. World War II, I was in Romania, Greece, Yugoslavia. Helped evacuate part of the Nazi intelligence apparatus just before the end of the war. We used those guys in fighting against the communists. In Italy, 48, we stole the elections. France, 49, broke the strikes. Overthrew Carino in the Philippines, Arbenz in Guatemala, Mozadegh in Iran. We were in Vietnam in 54, Indonesia, 58, Tibet, 59. Got the Dalai Lama out. We were good. Very good. Then we get into the Cuban thing. Not so good. Set up all the bases for the invasion. It's supposed to take place in October 62. Mm-hmm. Khrushchev sent the missiles to resist the invasion. Kennedy didn't invade. We were standing out there with our dicks in the wind. A lot of pissed off people, Mr. Garrison. Understand? I'll come to that later. So, 1963. I spent much of September 63 working on the Kennedy plan for getting all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 1965. This plan was one of the strongest, most important papers issued from the Kennedy White House. His National Security Action Memo 263 ordered home the first 1,000 troops for Christmas. But then in November, 1 week after the murder of the United President in Saigon, 2 weeks before the assassination of our president, a strange thing happened to me.
The Panama.
I do indeed. You are going to South Pole.
Man?
Why? Dr. Mooney's got all the details. I want you to check with him. Have yourself a nice vacation.
I was sent by my superior officer to Column Y. I was sent by General Y to the South Pole as a military escort for a group of international VIPs. I was on my way back in New Zealand. Was killed. Now, Moscow's charge is 7 p.m. Palestine, with Tibbetts murder. That's 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the next day, New Zealand time. But already, their papers in the entire history of this unknown 24-year-old man, Oswald, studio picture, detailed biographical data, Russian information, and we're pretty sure of the fact that he killed the president alone, although it took them 4 more hours before they even charged him with that crime in Dallas. Days of how that cover story was being put up, like we would in a black car. Anyway, after I came back, I asked myself, why Zaka, the chief of special ops, selected to travel to the South Pole at that time to do the job that any number of others could have been? And I wondered if it could have been because one of my routine duties, if I had been in Washington, would have been to arrange for additional security in Texas, so I decided to check it out. And sure enough, I found out that someone had told the 112th Military Intelligence Group, 4th Army Headquarters at Fort Sam Houston, to stand down that day over the protest of the unit commander, Colonel Rush. I believe this is significant because it is standard operating procedure, especially in a known hostile city like Dallas, to supplement the Secret Service. But even if we had not allowed the little top to be removed from the embassy, we would have placed at least 100 to 200 agents on the sidewalk without question. But only out of the window, human ambassador Adlai Stevenson stood on the head. There had already been several attempts on de Gaulle's life in France. We would have arrived days ahead of time, studied the room, checked all the doors, and those wide open empty windows overlooking the end. Never! We'd have had a Ross discovering the area the minute the wind went up. They'd have been on the radio. We'd have been watching the ground, packages rolled up, newspapers going around. Never would have known the man would have gone along the way. Just never would have allowed.
Glenn?
Yes.
What's with the speaker saying? It sounds like they're on the stage.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, I might point out that people should rent the snow while they hear the dialogue.
Yeah. Sorry about that. You can only bring the speaker, so that's
the reason the soundtrack stopped escaping.
Yeah, about a minute.
Yeah, it's not your speaker system, it's more it's a channel thing.
Yeah.
Across the
room. Of course, if you rented this in Blockbuster, that's a little confused.
I think it's just the.
Maybe you could tell the audience this crucial information that they're speaking about.
Yeah, but it's always saying.
Well, basically, we've gone over this. But just really goes through the history of American covert ops.
It sounded okay.
Just the. Glenn, come up here a second, would you? Glenn?
Yes.
Would you come here a second? Oh, what a day.
Let's just fix it back where it was.
Thank you.
Lynch isn't bad.
Just to fill in some downtime, one of the things that has strengthened in this country is the ability for class action suits. And since we haven't been able to bring attention to quite a close anything and all these meetings, is there any way we could actually do a class action lawsuit for the loss?
Kind of tough now because, you know, they just Bush just changed the class action lawsuits a few months ago. So it's really tough to bring those now. You never get any action in the courts. I mean, it's all kind of tied in.
Yeah, but see, everybody could actually sign up for it. So. I don't know. Just brainstorming. Well, specific harm is all the money is now going to the they would rule it, okay. It's hard to come up with something you need to.
I think your best bet is to, I've thought that many times too.
Have you?
Yeah, and I think our best bet as a public is to recognize the value of research.
There has only been one conspiracy trial in the Kennedy assassination. It was brought by then New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison.
The real killer.
There has only been one conspiracy trial in the Kennedy assassination. It was brought by then New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison.
The real killer of John Kennedy was a Central Intelligence Agency. And John Kennedy was not the only American leader murdered by the CIA. He was just the greatest.
This man has been described by the Northern press and even the Southern press as a fraud and as a wide-eyed lunatic.
He couldn't produce a thing that made any sense.
He dealt with certain facts convenient to him while avoiding other facts that weren't convenient to him.
Here he was, a local district attorney. What reason did he have to be investigating the President of the United States?
Jim Garrison is surely a controversy unto himself, a controversy within a controversy. Even many people who think that he was absolutely correct about the assassination and the conspiracy behind it think that Garrison was a wild man and that he did more harm than good. I can see the reasons for the complaints. I've looked at them fairly closely because I've done a study of Garrison. I come out of it thinking that he's one of the really first-rate class act heroes of this whole ugly story, which suffers so badly for heroes.
As children, we become accustomed to hearing fairy tales. They're always pleasant stories, and they're comforting to hear because good always triumphs over evil. At least, this is the way it is in fairy tales. However, in the real world, in which you and I must live, fairy tales are dangerous. They're dangerous because they're untrue. The conclusion of the Warren Report that President Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin is a fairy tale.
I found Jim Garrison to be a very conservative man, really someone rooted deeply in American tradition. He had been in the FBI, and he was a prosecutor for 12 years. This was not a flaming radical by any means.
He was known as the Jolly Green Giant down in New Orleans. The people down there really liked him immensely. They had seen how independent he had been in going after rackets down there and in taking the judges to task for not putting in enough time on the bench.
Jim Garrison was a feisty district attorney in New Orleans. And the very weekend of the assassination, as most good district attorneys, he had lots of tentacles out in the community and on the street. And he immediately began to get feedback that that Oswald had been there and that people had seen Oswald with various people, including David Ferry. And Oswald apparently had been in touch with David Ferry all the way back to the age of 15 when he had served in the Civil Air Patrol under David Ferry.
David Ferry was a very strange individual. He spoke five languages. He suffered from a rare illness called alopecia, where he had no hair on all over his body.
David Ferry was a guy who would glue his own wig on, and he put mohair above his eyes to simulate eyebrows. And he more or less looked like a Halloween pumpkin.
David, you know President Kennedy was assassinated on Friday. A man named Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested as a suspect. He was then murdered yesterday by a man named Jack Ruby. We've heard reports that Oswald spent the summer here in New Orleans, and we've been advised that you knew Oswald pretty well.
I never met anybody named Oswald. Anybody told you that has to be crazy.
Ferry, a very mysterious character, was arrested 2 days after the assassination on suspicions of having participated in a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy, was interrogated at great length by the Secret Service and the FBI, and then was released.
There was one event that struck him as being very funny. He investigated it very early on, turned the information over to a government agency, the FBI, feeling that there was enough there to investigate. They did not conclude the same thing, which caused his office a little bit of concern, like, gee, you know, we happen to think this is a very interesting thing. The FBI said, no, we don't believe that this is. And Jim let it lay. He let it lay for 3 years.
It was about 1966 when, you might say, I awoke from my dogmatic slumber, because like so many American people, I found it impossible to believe that the United States government would lie to us about something like this. Two things triggered me in two steps. First was a conversation I had with Senator Russell Long talking about the assassination, and he mentioned to me that there was no way in the world that kid, meaning Lee Oswald, could have shot up that car, and meaning Jack Kennedy, Governor Connally, the way that they say he did. And I said, are you telling me that you think the Warren Commission lied, that was all a lie? He said, absolutely, it had to be a lie.
The possibility of a conspiracy originating in New Orleans should have been investigated, and it was investigated by FBI agents and perhaps by Secret Service agents. Whether they found everything that was to be found is entirely a different matter.
So I set out for the Warren Commission volume, the whole 26 volumes plus the report, started digging into it, and it was boring reading, because one of the first things I discovered was most of the people they called had nothing to do with it. And early on I sensed that this was a snow job to keep the facts from becoming clear. If you look at the Zapruder film, one of the first things you see is he was killed by a shot from the front. So one of the first things I did when I was in the right position for it, I issued a subpoena for the Zapruder film to Life magazine, and they had to produce it.
The last thing that came up for him was, that really startled him, was when he read that Lee Harvey Oswald had been given a Russian test while in the Marines.
I saw the testimony of Colonel Folsom of the Marines. He mentioned the test Oswald had just taken in Russia. And somebody must have kicked him under a table, because he quickly added, he didn't do too well. He got almost as many wrong as he got right. Well, of course, that was, to me, just like saying, somebody saying, my dog is really stupid, because when we play chess, I can beat him 3 games out of 5.
He defected to the Soviet Union. He came back to the United States, where he was greeted with open arms. Nobody prosecuted him. Nobody said, you rejected your citizenship. You renounced it before. You're not allowed back here. He could bring back a Russian woman.
When Oswald returns to New Orleans in the summer of 63, he begins to pass out this communist literature. On this literature was an address, and the address was 544 Camp Street.
Saturday morning, by myself, I got up early and went down to 544 Camp Street, and then the building looked familiar, and I realized as I went around the corner to look at the other entrance that this was the old office in 1963 of Guy Bannister.
Sure, Guy Bannister, ex-FBI man, died a couple of years ago.
He used to recruit college students, infiltrate radical organizations on campus, headed the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. All out of this office.
It was an old antiquated building on the corner of Lafayette and Camp.
right near Lafayette Square, and Bannister had his office there. I had been in it on occasion, and I went in there one time with Lee to view some arms that they had brought from an old blimp base, David Perry and Lee and Jack Ruby.
Why Oswald was associated with that particular address remains one of the critical pieces of evidence in this whole investigation, and it indicates very strongly that all his passing out leaflets and literature favorable to Fidel Castro on the streets of New Orleans that summer actually was posturing to set up some type of an intelligence scenario.
Guy Bannister's office served as headquarters for something that we later found out was called Operation Mongoose. We found that David Ferry was one of the main people who was around there all the time, and that Bannister was running a training camp north of Lake Pontchartrain, very close to New Orleans, for Cuban exiles, right-wing mercenaries. They were training for what they hoped would be another invasion of Cuba. And they had amassed huge stockpiles of weapons and ammunition that were constantly being brought in and out of Guy Bannister's office, right in the center of the intelligence community. This had to be noticed by the FBI and the CIA offices that were right in proximity. While conducting his investigation, Jim ran across in the Warren Commission volumes an interview with Dean Andrews. Jim happened to know him because they had attended law school together at Tulane. On Saturday, the day after the assassination of President Kennedy, Andrews had received a strange phone call from a man named Clay Bertrand asking him, Andrews, to go to Dallas to represent Lee Harvey Oswald as his attorney.
Well, Clay Bertrand, whoever the real man might be, as one of the participants in the assassination. And a man named Dean Andrews is protecting him by not giving his real name. I decided I wanted his real name. So I set up a meeting at lunch.
Well, I don't know what he's up to. He's picking me like chicken, shucking me like corn, storing me like an oyster. I mean, he ain't put nothing down but air.
Dean, are you trying to tell me that you received a call from Clay Bertrand, who was a client of yours, but you don't know what he looks like because you've never seen him, and he'd say, scout on him, my man.
He's got the right ta-ta, but the wrong ho-ho.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to call you into the grand jury, and I spoke some of his language, so to speak. I said, now, when you dance into the grand jury, you better lay the truth on him, or else you are going to be indicted and go to trial for perjury. We tried him, and the jury found him guilty.
So Jim wanted to find out who this Clay Bertrand was. Since he got nowhere with Dean Andrews, he decided to look into the French Quarter, where most of Dean Andrews' clientele came from.
So we started hitting those bars every night and asking bartenders who Clay Bertrand was. Well, first we were bumping into stone wall, but one of our assistants had grown up in the Sixth Ward. One of his relatives happened to know this bartender and called and said, why don't you just tell the truth? And so we went back and asked the man again, and he was perfectly candid. He said, sure. He said, I don't know why they're not telling you, but everybody down here in the quarter knows who Clay Bertrand is. That's Mr. Shaw, Clay Shaw.
This came as a great shock because Clay Shaw was one of the most upstanding and respected members of the community in New Orleans. He was a pillar of society. He had done a lot to restore the city, and he had been the founder of the International Trademark.
He could become the ambassador to the court of St. James tomorrow, and English wouldn't blink an eye because he would fit into the world of diplomacy so beautifully, and yet he never graduated from college.
Shaw denied knowing Oswald, denied knowing Ferry, denied knowing any of the people who identified him as Clay Bertrand.
I am not Clay Bertrand.
But Jim kept looking, and what they came across was a rumor that Shaw, Ferry, and Oswald had been spotted together in a little town called Clinton.
Garrison located witnesses in Clinton, Louisiana, who would testify that in 1963, during the drive to get blacks to register to vote, that Lee Harvey Oswald showed up at the voters' registration
site, and he was accompanied by Clay Shaw and David Ferry.
Now, what would a guy like Clay Shaw be doing with someone like David Ferry? Okay, what would a guy like Clay Shaw be doing with somebody like Lee Harvey Oswald? Okay, but witness after witness testified about this Clinton trip.
With Clay Shaw, another part of the evidence that Garrison had acquired was a party that was attended supposedly by Clay Shaw, by Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry at Ferry's apartment. And the witness in this case, who also attended the party, Perry Russo, said that they discussed an assassination of John Kennedy.
I went up there and walked up this spiral staircase, up the steps, and I met Oswald. I had met Shaw. I met Shaw there. I had seen Shaw before and was introduced. There were several Cubans. We talked about different things. And Ferry was in a heated mood. He came up with ideas on assassinating Castro. He came up with ideas on assassinating Kennedy and blame it on somebody that likes Castro.
And the conspiracy under the law is the same as committing the murder. It was my jurisdiction, New Orleans. It was my duty to locate and prosecute anybody in New Orleans that had something to do with assassination, and I got somebody when we got Clay Shaw.
Up until this point, Jim's investigation had been conducted in entire secrecy. It was funded by publicly accountable funds, and they had used about $8,000. An enterprising young reporter, Rosemary James, had tracked the accounts and had found out that money had been used for the Kennedy investigation.
Dave Snyder and I, who was also a reporter for the State's Item, spent quite a bit of time talking to people, and eventually we had enough for a story.
It goes public. And once they decide that it's on the JFK plot, the entire press of the Western world descends on New Orleans. The second thing that happens is that David Ferry mysteriously dies about a week later.
The circumstances of his death to this day have never been satisfactorily explained. And he had a direct link to Oswald. He had a link to Clay Shaw.
Jim made it what he called a command decision. That was to arrest Clay Shaw and charge him with conspiring to murder the president. I think he felt that he didn't have quite the case that he would have liked to if he had been able to keep it secret. But since he had been forced into the public eye, he wanted to make sure he had Clay Shaw before Clay Shaw mysteriously disappeared.
Quiet! All right, Bill, will you start again? Mr. Shaw is in custody at this time, sir. I said the arrest was made in this office, Mr. Shaw is still here.
I don't want to comment in any way on Mr. Shaw because I want to lean over backwards not to infringe on any of his rights.
I think it was most evil bringing in an innocent man, Clay Shaw, and pillaring him in the public eye or attempting to, and causing him great difficulties, of course.
Garrison's main theory is that it was a branch of the CIA that had more or less decided to do this on their own. Shaw, it turns out, had a long record of contacts with the CIA.
Later on, we found out that Shaw was a CIA man, that in fact he had been a colonel in the OSS during World War II.
I know he was the director of the at the International Trade Mart, where we had information that he was involved with the CIA. In fact, I was told that by Dave Ferry.
Clay Shaw was arrested on March 1st, 1967. Jim was under a great deal of pressure, and what he did was he presented his case before a grand jury, and the grand jury returned an indictment against Shaw on charges of conspiring to murder the president. At that point, strange things began happening in Jim's office. He found that the FBI had bugged his offices. Everywhere Jim traveled, FBI was following him.
We were so naive. We were like children. The office had been thoroughly penetrated, and in many cases files were missing, and in other cases files were turned over wholesale amounts to the defense. They had more of our files than we had when the case started.
Got no cooperation at all from the FBI.
tried to get different witnesses before our grand jury to testify under oath, you know, which were blocked by the federal government.
Mr. Garrison, do you feel that your case has really been hurt by this lack of cooperation with the federal government?
As to preventing us from being successful, there's no chance in the world. I'm sure that they think they can.
It was in March of 1967 that Clay Shaw was charged with conspiring to kill President Kennedy. Now, almost 2 years later, Shaw will go on trial here, in this building, tomorrow morning.
I'd like to, point out how close that Garrison really came to cracking this case. You know, you talked about prosecuting it, I mean, Garrison really was on the case and had figured a big chunk of it out, even with all the infiltration of this law office. If you pick up our new pamphlet, there's a book that's about to be released by Joe Mellon called Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK Assassination, the Case That Should Have Changed History. I have a 3-hour interview with her and Earl Schoenman. If anybody's interested, I can make them some copies. That she did some original research and just drove around the country and interviewed people related to the case. And there's so much incredible information that's still coming out from JFK, and I would assume decades from now there'll be some incredible information coming out about 9/11. I also, if you do pick this up, the book below that called Let Justice Be Done by William Davey. It's also about the Jim Garrison trial, a case against Clay Shaw and others. So those two books specifically about Jim Garrison, every book on this, the few books that we list on the JFK media resources are really excellent. The movie JFK itself by Oliver Stone is based on Crossfire by Jim Mars and On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison. So, any questions about this material at all? All right, we're going to switch again to 9/11. And would you like to make some comments, Ray, or about...
Before you drop the JFK thing, an interesting article written by Jim T. Eugenio, one of the people who was in that
right.
In there, he said that, I guess the long guy wrote the article, but there are actually two Oswalds.
Mm-hmm.
With Lee Oswald and Harvey Oswald. One of them was born in, I think, Texas or New Orleans. A big guy, didn't know any Russian at all. The other one was born in New York City, possibly immigrated from Eastern Europe and knew Russian fluently. And you just sort of need these two separate timelines where, you know, one of them's in Russia, you know, married a Marina, and the other one's out in Miami or Florida, you know, hanging out with Cuban exiles at the same time. So it's, not sure how far they went with that information, but it's really interesting.
That is interesting. Anyway.
Are you going to drop this before the resolution of the trial?
Am I going to, you mean play any more of this video?
Yeah, are we dropping this right there? I mean, it sounds like you had a good
Let's listen to Ray.
Well, this is going to be short. I see some familiar faces. How many know who Jim Walter is? Okay, not everybody. He's the millionaire who's put his money where his mouth is. He's spent millions running ads in major newspapers and magazines. But anyway, he has he's got the website Reopen 9/11, and he, for quite some time, has had an offer out on his website, $100 or $1 million contest if you can prove how the World Trade Centers could collapse in the time frame that they did collapse without planned major demolition. And that you can go on that website and find that the contest details. And I spun off a couple here on the web, and you can pass those out to anybody that's interested. Also, many of you may have seen in the paper the last couple weeks ago about the physics professor from BYU who concludes that bombs, not planes, toppled the World Trade Center. And some of you may have heard Morgan Reynolds, who was here at our last presentation, who came out with that same conclusion. I've got a couple copies of the BYU professor here, if anybody's interested. And finally, many of you may know that on Jim Walters' website, reopen911.org, he has a free DVD that he puts out. And I contacted him, and his organization sent up some of these DVDs. So anybody who's interested here, we have quite a number of them. And if you'd like to have a DVD of 9/11 that really has quite a bit of information on it, you may have it. That's all I have to say, Richard.
Anybody else? I'll put them on back.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much. And on that note, let's watch those buildings go down magically. You know, building number 7 going down, that would be like if somebody ran into your house and your neighbor's house falls down. That'd be a neat trick. But that's what they expect us to believe.
My name is Eric Hufschmid. I wrote the book Painful Questions and Analysis of the September 11th Attack and produced the video Painful Deceptions.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Well, to me, it's a sign like you're finding a cancerous lump on your body. It's a sign that our governments are corrupt, our media is lying to us. It's a sign that we've got to wake up and deal with this issue of what kind of government do we have? You know, the voters have to start paying more attention. We have to start getting involved. We have to become responsible citizens. We've got to take care of our society. Well, it came about slowly because, like most people, I was at first thinking, no, it sounds like these are just nutty conspiracy theories. But eventually they got through to me by just going over and over it. I started looking through the photos and the news reports, and I realized, you know, there's something to these conspiracy theories. The government's explanation just doesn't explain the photos that we see, the rubble, the dust that comes out of these buildings. Something's really wrong here.
Do they normally produce this much dust? Well, since fire has never caused a steel building to crumble before, I guess we'll never know if this dust is typical.
Well, nobody will ever know exactly except the people involved, but it looks like, to me, the Arabs were patsies. The entire attack was conducted by the government, and it was simply to perhaps incite anger so that they could do who knows what, start wars or make changes to the government to give themselves and their friends positions that they would never otherwise get, and perhaps to boost certain budgets. But something is definitely wrong. It's just to wait for all the details, we'll never know exactly. All of the information in my book and video is right available in the internet, newspapers, television. I don't have any secret sources. All the information is right in front of our faces. All we have to do is open our eyes and look. They're not actually hiding it. They may be hiding certain details, but the information's there. You cannot commit a crime of this magnitude without leaving clues all over the place. And there are clues all over. Just look at them. If you look through history, this is not the first scam that the government has been involved in. They've been involved in others, and they've gotten away with all of them. 100% success rate. Where do you see this sort of a success rate? They've been exposed. Every scam has been exposed. And so what do they have to worry about me for? They're probably thinking, oh, here it goes again. We'll just ignore it and move on to the next scam. So I don't think they have to worry. Until the people wake up and say they've had enough, what am I? I'm like the Kennedy investigators or the people investigating Martin Luther King. One of the things that bothers people the most is just, it's like opening a door to a black room and seeing crime and corruption.
Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction, there's no doubt.
A lot of people just, I think, get scared of this and shut the door and run back to the television where it's comfortable and entertaining. A lot of people have, from what I've personally seen at least, a lot of people are having trouble dealing with the fact that this world is beyond anything they thought of. The corruption is beyond what they dreamed of. And it's shocking them. It's upsetting them. And this scam was so big, I think that is one of the reasons they're getting away with it. It's hard to rate them, but it does seem like this one has the most, perhaps the most people involved. It seems like even other nations, some people from other nations are helping this one. So this may be the biggest in terms of people and money and planning. But when you consider that it almost appears as if these are growing in size, you have to wonder, what's the next one going to be if we don't do something?
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
When you look at what's been going on, why would they stop? Why are they going to suddenly say, okay, we've had enough? I think there's going to be more, and it's trying to figure out what the purpose is and who's behind it that's so confusing. I was only aware of the Kennedy assassination, and even that, I was only aware of that for a few years because I grew up, like most people, believing the official stories. So when the 9/11 attack occurred, that was really the second scam I was aware of. Well, after I wrote my book, people were telling me, did you hear about General Ben Parton? And I'm thinking, who? And here we have the military's weapons expert, an explosive expert, looking into the Oklahoma City bombing and producing a report that says there is no way a truck bomb full of fertilizer and fuel oil would have the power to do what it did to that building. Now, this is one of our own military's experts on explosives. I had never heard about him. Most people never heard about him. And yet he's got this report, the calculations, you can go over it yourself. He shows that it could not have been possible. Here's another sign that it was a scam and they're just covering it up and nobody even knows about it. In the Oklahoma City building where the Murrah building was blown up, there was a policeman who had run into the building to help get people out, to save them. And he, as he was running in and out of the building saving people, he fell through a floor and hurt his back. And about a year later, the city decided to give him a Medal of Honor. And about 3 days before the ceremony, the news reports tell us that he committed suicide. Now, of course, on the internet, we have a lot of other theories that he was dragged through the fields, he was beaten and then shot. And the news reports describe it as he tried to slit his wrists and then shot himself. So we have to wonder, is this another of these suspicious suicides? It's another murder to keep somebody with evidence from talking. Rubble, first of all, was hauled away from that very first day on September 11th and was being sold as scrap metal, which is a violation of our laws. And so even though there were people complaining, such as Fire Engineering Magazine, to stop this, they just ignored it. And the people investigating, some of the same investigators were some of the same people investigating Oklahoma City. So it's almost as if they just took the same people they did on another scam, brought them over to this one, and said, well, do it again. It worked the last time. And so we really don't have any rubble to look through. We really don't have any investigation. The FEMA report that was finally produced doesn't really say anything. I think what they've decided to do is not say much of anything, because if you look at the previous scams, like the Kennedy investigation, the Warren report was extensive. And it shows that I think they've learned the best thing is to say as little as possible and just move on. Well, I would say the ideal company is the one who helped clean it up, which is Controlled Demolitions Incorporated. They've got the experience to do this. This is what they do for a living. They look at buildings and they figure out how many explosives to put in and where to put them and what size they should be. They do this all the time. It wouldn't be that difficult for them. And they were there to clean it up as if they were already there in the first place. So I think that would be the most logical explanation. And by coincidence, as far as trying to figure out how they did it, many years ago in the 1980s, I had developed software that will talk over a radio link to some mobile units that people could carry around with them. Now, this was simply to send data and receive data, but the same exact software, just modified a little, could be set to detonate explosives that had been placed in the towers through this radio link. So to me, that may be one of the reasons why it occurred to me that they're using a radio-linked explosive to set these off, and a computer is detonating them in a certain sequence. By coincidence, if you want to call it a coincidence, the two towers were given to the same person, Larry Silverstein, who already owned Building 7. He got a 99-year lease on it a few weeks before the September 11th attack, and the news reports say that he was changing security and maintenance personnel. Yes, he says he got a phone call from the fire department, and they were telling Silverstein that they may not be able to contain the fires in Building 7. And so Silverstein says, well, maybe the best thing to do is just demolish the building. And so he's implying then, he says that they then watched the building, which implies that these people, in the space of one afternoon, called up for a demolition of a building, even though there's traffic jams everywhere, even though the offices are full of files from the CIA, the IRS, all sorts of other tenants, nobody bothers to clean the place out, nobody bothers to tell the tenants, and they're supposedly bringing the building down in a couple of hours. I mean, it's almost like, why would he say this except to laugh in our faces?
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Well, jet fuel is like hydrocarbons. It's like gasoline, candle wax, propane, the natural gas in your stove. It melts, it burns at about 1800 degrees Fahrenheit at its maximum when it's perfectly mixed with the air. But in a fire like when you see a jet plane crashing or an automobile crash, the oxygen is not mixing properly with the fuel, and so you get a lot of soot and a lot of orange flames. The temperature will be below 1800 degrees Fahrenheit, and steel melts at about 2600 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is no possible way those reports about steel melting from the jet fuel, it violates scientific rules. The most that jet fuel could have done is heat the steel up, made it a little bit weaker. Well, the investigation was being conducted by FEMA, but some of the engineers and scientists were complaining there really wasn't much of a budget. One of them described it as a shoestring budget. There were calls by some of the engineers for volunteers. They couldn't pay them, so they're saying, who can just come by once in a while to help us out? It was a pathetic investigation. There was no real money. It's as if the government never really wanted any investigation at all. And of course, while this is going on, we've got people in Fire Engineering Magazine complaining that it's a farce. But that was ignored also. Well, I don't know about the engineers doing the study. It's more the people who are reading it and complaining that there's really nothing in this report. They're not explaining anything. Like the way Building 7 comes down, almost their exact words are, we don't know. We don't know what caused the fire. We don't know what caused the collapse. They're basically saying, well, here's how the structure of the building is, and we don't know what happened to it. Most people don't even know what Building 7 is, or that about 5:30 in the afternoon, the entire building just collapsed into a little pile of rubble. And if the video of it, there are at least five different video cameras that were recording this, and it shows it to be exactly like a conventional demolition of an old building. And the interesting thing, of course, is that our government completely ignores this building and never tells us how those Arab hijackers managed to knock that building down. The fire's at 3 p.m., and there's only a couple little fires on a couple offices of just a couple floors of this 47-story building. So how did these teeny little fires bring a building down? It doesn't make any sense. No fire has ever done this before, and yet the entire building pulverizes. It didn't just crack, it pulverized into a little pile of rubble. The building had a variety of tenants. It was an office building. It had IRS, I think, and the CIA, Department of Defense. I don't remember all the tenants. But the strangest thing was that on the 23rd floor, the mayor of New York City had a special office that had been reinforced with bulletproof and bombproof windows, which by itself is not that strange, but this place had its own air supply and its own water supply. So you have to wonder, why are they putting this, what appears to be a military bunker, in the 23rd floor of an office building? The rest of the building wasn't protected like this. But if you look at where this floor is located, it gave a great view of the towers, the entire World Trade Center area, and so it would have been an ideal location for the people involved in this attack to be planning it, to set it all off, to look at where the planes were crashing into the towers, and then decide how to set the explosives off, and when to set them off, because they could see when people stopped coming out of the buildings. It was a perfect opportunity to be sitting in that building and manage this entire attack. Well, there were apparently a lot of files in Building 7 and the towers, and then Building 6 had some U.S. Customs files. A lot of crimes were being investigated, and there was a lot of evidence and documents about these crimes. I think even Enron was in some of these buildings. They all went down. All of these files seem to have been destroyed. So here we have yet another possible reason some people joined this scam, is to get rid of some of these files, get rid of some of these evidence, and basically put an end to those investigations. By a coincidence, again, they evacuated the building at about 9 o'clock in the morning. And so the building was supposedly empty the entire day. But for all we know, it was only empty of its regular employees. And on that 23rd floor, there were people inside, you know, managing the attack.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
APOO, and with a bit of struggle, I was able to get on Dennis Bernstein. Didn't seem to be a perimeter board, but I had no indication that they wouldn't do that, that all the indications were that they were going in that direction. And I would suggest to you, with Cheney in charge of the black box at this late point, that we are still in continuity of government since 9/11. D.C., if you come to it, you will see how militarized it remains in the presence of the military all over. They don't even talk to the cops. They just come out and close off sections of the streets whenever they want to. Okay. The D.C. police are ignored. It's a colony anyway. And we've never had real local rule in D.C. Our license plates say taxation without representation. We did that so Bush had to put one on his car. Foreknowledge certainly was possible of these events. In a covert operation, you spend more time on the cover story and more personnel on the cover story than you do on setting up the actual incident. This is important because cover stories include false sponsorship. All right. The first week, they were blaming everything on the church committee. That was a Frank Church, Senator Frank Church had these committees in the 70s that exposed the excesses of the FBI and the CIA. And according to them, the legal things that they were forced to do to not be illegal, to not hire assassins and take part in assassinations, you know, to clean up their act with COINTELPRO and all the dirty tricks, all of that had just shackled them so totally that they were incapable of responding or knowing that 9/11 was going to happen. You know, you believe that? Okay. You know, fund them some more. You know, see what else they don't know. All right? But this is what we're told. The church committee is to blame, and then we were told that we're redefining justice. The first comment was, I like those old posters from the West that said, wanted dead or alive. Those are bounty hunter posters. You're not going to have a trial. You're allowed to shoot the guy and bring him dead over the horse back, and that's good enough. Then we had the quote, we'll bring them to justice, or we'll bring justice to them. What does that mean? That means revenge. Okay? But we don't need these international courts. We can have military tribunals run by the U.S. in secret. We don't have to present the evidence. That's all secret anyway. You might figure out how we're getting evidence against somebody. You know, and you don't have to be able to confront the people that are accusing you. You don't need an attorney, or if you have an attorney, we can tap them. They just start to redefine it, and one of the major things they're redefining is something called the Posse Comitatus Act. And this grows out of the British experience of the U.S. people with the British, who combined military and police forces in their occupation of their colony here. And that's why the Bill of Rights has things like, you know, you can't quarter our house and take our goods. You can't have unreasonable search and seizure. All of these rights that were put forward by Jefferson and Washington agreed to put into the Constitution came out of their experience of those rights being violated by a joint military police force of the British colonial rule. And that began to, it was a bright line in the Constitution that military and police are two different things. And that bright line began to erode at the end of the Civil War when occupying northern troops took over police functions in southern towns, were doing hangings and different things, and they passed an act in Congress in 1965 said, no, we're going back to the Constitution, and there's a bright line, and Posse Comitatus says military is one thing, police are another. After Vietnam, one thing that they began to do was to militarize the police themselves, to make sure that a lot of veterans got jobs in the police, to begin to use military terms and war terms in police operations, to train police on military bases in war tactics and psychological operations, to create militarized police like SWAT, to create military operations against civilian criminal, alleged criminal activities, like MOVE, like Wounded Knee, like Waco. These were done by joint military task forces that included the FBI and the police, as well as the DOD and the military. Okay? I mean, the entry device, isn't that a nice term, that they dropped on top of the house of MOVE in Philadelphia, the entry device, was C4 military explosive, which the police are not supposed to have. I found out that on a nearby base in New Jersey, they had practiced for 6 months in a helicopter figuring out how to drop C4 onto a simulated mock-up of the MOVE building. Okay. The other thing they did during the Bush and counter-drug administration, you know, they were about as counter-drug. I mean, if they countered any drugs, it was because they were wiping out one delivery route and putting in another. Okay. I mean, they increased the number of drugs massively, but under this cover that they were countering drugs, they not only created counterinsurgency forces in other countries, as they still have in Colombia, you know, under the excuse that they were fighting drugs, but they began to give military forces police functions in the drug war. And now, Senator Warner, since September 11th, has been calling for all the agencies to work together, have cooperation, and let's get rid of Posse Comitatus. So that's one thing that's happening, is that there's an erosion. And if you want a model for where we're going, go back and study Peru under Fujimori and Montesini. Mancini's from CIA, Fujimori comes in. They say there's a threat of terrorists called the Shining Path. They dismantle the constitution of the country. They take away the civil liberties. They establish secret military tribunals. And they do what the Bush administration is doing now. So you have an erosion of those two very basic concepts. But if you remember the story, the first link to the Al-Qaeda terrorists on 9/11 came from the FBI being led to a car in Logan Airport. They were led to a car because a guy said that he was taking a flight out of Logan that morning, and in the course of trying to find a parking space, he got in what he called a road rage argument from four Arab men in a car that wanted the parking space. And then later when he saw that the planes had been hijacked, he called the FBI thinking he would lead them to the car where these Arab men had parked. Well, I mean, really, 5 years in the planning or something, big secret covert operation on the day of the thing, you're going to have a road rage argument in the parking lot of Logan Airport. I mean, you're already tagged as an Arab. You want to be tagged as an angry Arab? I mean, is it more likely that whoever this was that led them to the car is part of the game, that there was never any road rage argument? This reminds me of the bundle that was dropped outside of Kniep Amusement in Memphis, Tennessee, 5 minutes before Dr. Martin Luther King was shot, that had a rifle in it, which we now know was not a murder rifle, but which Roland or James Earl Ray. This is taking it by the nose to the phony evidence. And what's in the car? A copy of the Quran inside of a suitcase, and a flight manual for that type of plane written in Arabic. I said, if you went to the trouble to get it, why would you leave it in the car? It's not like the guy next to you is going to read Farsi and say, hey, isn't that a flight manual for this plane? You know, I cram the last minute. Okay, I got it all down. No need to take it with me. What the hell is that? This is false evidence. And then that car is, you know, relates to the IDs of four of these Al-Qaeda people. And, you know, they came down from Canada and they rented the car in Boston and blah, and now we've got our evidence. And we know who did it, you know, within the day we got all the names. One thing that confused me was that for the first 3 days, there was not a mention of ethnicity. They said men with bombs, men with knives, men with box knives. They weren't saying Arab. I mean, I know America. If you've got ethnicity, it's mentioned. If Arabs are black or, you know, Hispanic, it doesn't matter. If it's not white boys, when you say men with knives, you mean white men with knives. Okay. Because the others aren't men. And so, in all these early cell phones, they didn't mention the ethnicity. And finally, in one story, they claimed that the wife of the guy that was like, let's roll, and the hero on Flight 93, she said that there were four Arab guys with red headbands on. The red headbands? And when they put them on the plane because they didn't know who each other were, they sure as hell didn't put them on before they got on the plane, did they? You know, I mean, what was that? So, I don't know still who did what, or who they were, but then everywhere these guys went, they made themselves obvious. They weren't hiding. We had four of them living in a house in Langley out near me, in the bedroom community out there at the CIA, in these little bungalows. They made so much trouble, two of the neighbors called the CIA and reported them. There were other ones the night before went into a titty strip bar and, you know, put a Quran on the bar. They said America's, and they're drinking, and they said America's going to be bloody tomorrow. I mean, what is this? To me, it looks like false sponsorship. Let me see. Hit most of my points. Oh, I like that. Yeah. Muhammad Atta's passport was found as they were looking through the rubble that day or the next day in New York. His passport from the plane went through the fire, flew out of the building, and was found in the rubble. Yeah, no, it wasn't burned up, and it was actually found in all that rubble. I mean, the only way you found it in that rubble is the guy in front of you dropped it. That's all. If it was found at all. But come on. I mean, that's like they said they found the axle within a half an hour of the truck in the 93 bombing. They said the axle must have gone down, so they climbed out and found this axle and says, oh, we got the axle, and that tells us it was rented in New Jersey. I never seen that written on an axle. You know? And then the guy that rented it went back three times because he said it was stolen and he was trying to get his deposit back. I mean, what is this? You're going to take a truck and blow up a building and you're going to go back and try and get a deposit? Nobody's going to figure it out. This is like Timothy McVeigh. You know what I call him? I call him the schmuck in the truck. Why? Because he stopped twice within 45 minutes of the bomb at the Murtaugh building, on the street with another guy in the cab, at a gas station at a corner, and what was he stopping for? Directions to the Murtaugh building. He's going to go to the trouble of load up a bomb in a truck, and he doesn't know where he's going. You know, where he's going to drop it off? Oh, I'm supposed to bomb the Murtaugh building. Where's that? You guys know where the Murtaugh building is? I mean, if for no other reason, you don't want to be remembered, do you? Looking for the building. I mean, what is that? He's a guy that just is following orders. He gets there, and his car is there, and he picks up his car and leaves. The car is parked there. So it's like, take this truck, and your car will be there. He doesn't notice that there's no license plates on the car. They pick him up. In a state, first state trooper of the season picks him up because he has no license plate, pulls him over. A blue van pulls in front of him, according to the trooper's report. The blue van pulls in, and they arrest him, and the guy says, do you have any weapons? And McVeigh, who's just killed 180 people or more and bombed this whole building, says, yeah, here's my weapon. A little lamb. And then he's arrested, he's put in the back of the trooper's car, and then after he's secured, the trooper goes up front to the blue van and he says to the driver, I wasn't pulling you over, you're free to go. But he notes in the report that on the front seat of the blue van there are two license plates. Does that tell you anything? The schmuck in the truck. Okay. I mean, somebody's playing us for a sucker. And they're playing us for a sucker on 9/11 in the same way and in the same operations. But let me get to one more thing at least, which is anthrax. That's almost as good a story, if not better. Okay, we have anthrax attacks just as everybody's starting to come down from 9/11, and we have anthrax attacks. Do the terrorists go after Reagan? Or I'm sorry, about or after Bush? Do they go after Rumsfeld? Do they go after Cheney? Do they go after the Republican leadership in the Congress who's carrying on the war against Afghanistan? No. Where do they send them? The first place to get an anthrax envelope, as you may remember, is the tabloid headquarters in Florida. When I first read that, I thought, well, you know, the tabloids are a CIA propaganda tool anyway. I figured this is a false story, but the guy actually dies. He's a photo editor at this paper. Now it's said in the paper today that it was being spread by the copying machine. It was spreading the anthrax, and it got into the keyboard on his computer, and that's how it killed him. But it's just another coincidence. He's a photo editor at the tabloids who happened to be the photo editor that first put in pictures of Bush's daughters being arrested for drunk driving. It's just a coincidence. Okay, then where do they go? They go to Rather and Brokaw of NBC and the national news networks. That's who they scare next. And, you know, I'm no friend of them. I know Rather was part of the lies of the Kennedy assassination. But relative to the current scope of discussion, these are liberals in the media. Okay, because the discussion has shifted so far to the right that it's a debate between an open fascist and a moderate conservative, which means that a liberal is what a commie was in the 50s, and it means I'm so far over there to the left, I'm a terrorist. All right, and the rest of us probably in the room. You know, you look like terrorists to me anyway. And anybody can be one. James Jarboe, in February when I was in Seattle, said that the largest and most dangerous terrorist organization in the United States is Earth First. Oh, I wish that it were so. You know, I wish that it were so. You know, but the largest and most dangerous terrorist organization in the United States are at Langley and at the Pentagon, and have been for many years. Well, of course we're terrorists because we are outside the government and we have less power. We are only able to wage asymmetrical warfare. And we're fighting for justice. However we fight, we're terrorists even if we don't use weapons within that framework. So these are liberals. And then the main opponents of the Bush domestic agenda get envelopes, Daschle and Leahy, and a spillover to Feingold. Okay? And also the main opponents up till that day of the U.S. Patriot Act, who were questioning the U.S. Patriot Act up until they got them anthrax envelopes. And what's in the envelopes? An anthrax that's so sophisticated they said it couldn't have been developed in the Soviet Union or the United States. I said, what's left? Outer space? And who else is left to develop something? But, you know, let's not admit it could come from here. It hasn't got any aluminum tracing because it's not from Iraq. So we do the chemical tests on it. And then we do a DNA test on it. And lo and behold, it's Ames strain anthrax. That means it's U.S. anthrax. It means it comes from the most common place that anthrax comes from in the United States, University of Iowa at Ames, who maintained an archive of every known strain of anthrax. Anthrax is a natural disease. It's zoonotic. It passes from animals to humans. It's a farm disease. They've known about it since the 1920s. They took every strain and also tested those strains for antibiotics and other responses on those strains. And there's a whole archive kept of small samples so that they can be cultured and used. And there's a paper trail. So if you want this particular strain of anthrax from this particular batch, you send it out and there's a paper trail. Who experimented on it? Who ordered it? 10 days before the envelopes are sent, the FBI calls the University of Iowa at Ames and tells them to destroy the archive. After 70 years, which means that we know it came from Ames, but we don't know from what batch. We can't tell from what batch. And without knowing from what batch, we can't tell where it went to, even though there was a paper trail before they destroyed it. The FBI called 10 days before and had the batch destroyed. That was in the New York Times. The bungling FBI. Was mailed. Yes. And when they looked at this anthrax, they said, this is like nothing we've ever seen. There's a trillion spores per gram. It had been 1 to 2 billion spores per gram in the previously weaponized anthrax. It's also so distributable, so fluffy, which means it's got no electromagnetic bonding on these individual spores, that anything will spread it. You know, the wind will spread it, it spreads like hell. And it's more lethal. And what does that match? Is that the next generation of anthrax that I told you about, that it was ready to test on September the 6th? I think it is. And then they not only went to Ames, it suddenly became clear that it had been weaponized through Fort Detrick. And the investigation went to the gate of Fort Detrick and it stopped dead. For months we didn't hear anything about the anthrax investigation. And now what do we hear? It's one lone nut.
I'd like to thank everybody for coming. Before we go, I'm just going to say a few words. And in 2 days, on Tuesday at 8:30 p.m., that's the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And hopefully, if we work, we can have honest elections and have some decent representatives. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Here's Glenn.
Let me tell you what happened and what didn't happen in this building on September the 10th and September the 11th of this year. Several different people active in the group checked with the library way back in July to use this room on the afternoon of September the 11th to have Morgan Reynolds, the chief economist for the Department of Labor in the first George W. Bush administration, to speak at this library. We asked them in July. We got a range of answers. One was, oh, we're switching to a new computer system the next day, and we might need to do some manual procedures in this room on the 11th. The answers ranged from that to, it was the branch next to PCC Cascade, and they said, oh, it's very strange. No, we're not allowed to book rooms in any Multnomah County library in the months of August and September. Notice went out that we did have a room for September the 10th. The audio for that is on the CAGU website in their archives. About noon on Sunday, a friend called me and said, "Oh, I thought your event at the library was yesterday." He said, "Well, yeah, it was." "Well, then how come I just heard about a September 11th event at the library this morning on Channel 6? And I said, "By mistake, I didn't." So anyway, I called Channel 6, and telling of the corporate media, the same woman who answered the phone was the one who did their daily community calendar, which tells you, you know, it's all done by computers and satellites. I mean, there's nothing local. Anyway, she was flustered. "Oh, I must have got it wrong." So she then went and checked. There was an ad in the Oregonian on Saturday. I don't know whether that was a Sunday edition or one of the Saturday editions, for an event here at the library, not in even the relative privacy of this room, in the they call it the Connors Gallery up on the third floor, called Allegiances, a Public Conversation, with ringmasters Margaret Carter. That woman is certainly sold. We don't know what kind of incentive plan she's on from whoever, and some second-rate poet whose father was a big deal. And Margaret Carter, if someone said anything she didn't like, she was down on them like a banshee. In fact, we even have we have the audio, in fact, of a meeting that was here. Cable has it. We've never put it out. I think we probably will now that I've referred to it on the video that, or the audio that we'll be having on the web tonight. This whole proceedings of the afternoon, including the audio from the video, should be on the website by 7-ish this evening, if everything goes right. I'd now like to introduce you to Chris Andrea. She is the hero of the morning news just about every day on cable. She and I presented to the program committee at KWU, a program for late night, 3 to 5 in the morning, called WTC 7. And I'm going to let Chris take it from here, please.
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess we'll get to, I don't really need this, I have a really loud voice. Do I have to use this? Anyway, yeah, I think everybody at KWU knows a little bit about this. We want... invite anybody to participate. You can say anything that you want. We're all collecting material right now from events like this and others in order to have a lot of material to present, the idea being that it will stimulate and inspire and initiate. Let me say initiate. I have a problem with people that say instigate. It really bugs me. Initiate dialogue. And bring up even more questions than we're aware of. I mean, if we already know to ask this much, and all the speakers, I mean, in the film clips and whatnot today, if we know enough to ask that, then there must be a universe of other stuff, too, that needs explaining. And the more you dig into it, the more there is to find. And so that's why we want you to join us early in the morning, late at night, say anything you want, ask questions, and find out more, and also, if you can, contribute what you know and what you wonder about, too. Thanks, Lauren.
Let me explain. This has not been approved yet by KWU. It has been introduced to the program committee, and the response was very enthusiastic, universally enthusiastic. However, a slot has to open, and at that time, competitive bids have to go in for the time. I wouldn't like to be one of the competitive bids, frankly. But it isn't actually a done deal. When it is on the air, it will be archived every week, maybe streamed. I don't know. Certainly it will go out in the broadcast stream, but it will also be available at other times. That is all I need to say. Any other cable person or anybody whatsoever? Oh, let's wish a happy birthday to Phyllis Cardero. She's just a lovely friend of mine. That's it,
hey? Thank you. We do have a sign-up sheet. Thank you. We do have a sign-up sheet. If you want to get our emails, leave your email address. We'll know about all the events that we put on.